Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming and welcome. I'm delighted to be in the chair today because I think Comrade Gwyn Thomas was the only person at this summer school who knew me and came to my meetings in the park before I was ever in the party. He may well have asked me a few awkward questions, so today it gave me a wonderful opportunity of controlling the chair to get my revenge. Gwyn is going to speak today on In Whose Interest a Socialist Looks at the 1914-18 War, and I invite you all to give him a hard time.
Right. Thank you, Richard. Good morning, comrades and friends. First, a little apology. The talk I'm going to give isn't exactly the one that's on your programme, partly because I arrived here only to find that my lecture notes and all the supporting material were at home. Luckily, I was able to, with the help of Mike Foster there, to get the talk emailed across, together with a few supporting quotes. But a lot of what I had brought, had hoped to bring, to back up what I'm going to say, unfortunately, isn't available to me. Nevertheless, you can see behind me a few names, some of which might be unfamiliar to you. I assume you all know who Franz Ferdinand was. He's the poor guy that got shot in Sarajevo. Thank you. He was the nephew of Franz Joseph, the Austro-Hungarian Emperor. He wasn't the son. Franz Joseph didn't have a surviving son when he died. He had a daughter, but under the Austro-Hungarian constitution, she wasn't allowed to become empress. So Franz Ferdinand was next in line, so he was a fairly important bloke. This is the world, the latter half of the 19th century and up period leading up to the First World War. World manufacturing, you can see Great Britain in 1880 was nearly 30%. In 1913, the share Britain had of world trade was only 13.6. Germany, however, went from 8.5% of world manufacturing capacity in 1880. By 1913, had reached 14.8%. Russia was bobbing along, 7.6, 8.2. The USA, on the other hand, obviously the winner in this race, 14.7% in 1880. She had nearly a third of world manufacturing capacity in 1913. Underlying that was the population changes. Britain went from 1880 to the outbreak of war from 38 million to 45 million. France, on the other hand, wasn't up to the business. She was barely keeping up. 38 million, 39 million. Germany, 49 million to 65 million, quite a large leap. Austro-Hungaria, not quite such a large leap, but following the same trend, 41 million to 52 million. So that's the background to what I'm about to say. Now, we're only a few days short of the 100th anniversary of the shot that was heard round the world when Gavrilo Princip, a young anarchist, took out a pistol and shot Franz Ferdinand and his wife. Why did this particular episode, a Balkan crisis that began with a political murder in Bosnia, why did it prove so unmanageable and dangerous? I mean, after all, there have been a number of crises in this period where the powers of Europe had faced up to one another and had threatened armed are starting to use armaments to further their aims. First, let's frame our inquiry. What was the purpose of the assassination of Franz Ferdinand? Who was responsible for the killing, beside the assassins themselves, that is? Was war inevitable after the murder, or did policymakers use the crisis for their own purposes? And finally, why did the Balkan crisis lead to a world war in 1914, when other quite recent crises had not? Let's look at the actors and decision makers in this affair. Doing so, we'll highlight the factors that are somewhat different from those working among the great powers elsewhere in Europe and the ones that are cited generally in accounts of this period as being explanations for the war. I want to take a slightly different approach, possibly because, mostly because I think you're all fairly well aware with the standard accounts of this period. Those of you who aren't, there are a number of introductory books, if you're really interested. This one is very, very good. Gordon Martell, The Origins of the First World War, retails for about 10 quid, I think. It's one of these books that publishers produce to satisfy the demands of sixth formers and undergraduate students, and it contains a number of items of documentary evidence at the back. There's also another one, a really excellent little book. This is even more expensive than the other one. Holger Herwig, The Outbreak of World War One. This is a selection of readings from historians who have debated the causes of the First World War. A really excellent little book. Right, a common theme in the accounts of this period is the passive nature of great power policy. Leaders reacted to events rather than proactively manage the crisis. The image we have, or have been given, of people who know everything, pulling levers and making decisions and what have you, this isn't quite the true picture. More detailed studies have shown that as the crisis deepened, so did the ability of those making the decisions tend to falter under pressure. For example, the number of telegrams coming into the Foreign Office and having to, the British Foreign Office that is, and having to pass over the desk of Gray, the Foreign Secretary, and tripled within a very short period. And the mass of work that Edward Gray had to absorb is something horrendous. He's only himself to blame, of course. He shouldn't have taken the job if he can't take a joke. Yeah, so passive reaction, not actually managing the crisis, but trying to do the best they can in extremely trying circumstances. Both Germany and Russia mobilized their armies very, very quickly in this crisis. Germany and Russia also rashly committed themselves to support Balkan clients, Austria-Hungary in the case of Germany, and Serbia in the case of Russia. The reason they did this was that not to do so might cost them the trust and support of important allies and leave them isolated. It's a classic case of my enemy's enemy is my friend. Meanwhile, Austrians, Hungarians, Serbs consistently and consciously avoided compromise and risked war. This was high-stakes brinkmanship. Some 13 weeks passed, however, between the murder of Franz Ferdinand and the coming of general war at the end of August. In other words, there was plenty of time for calculation, caution and decision. So why did they choose war and who did so? The facts of the murder were not per se crucial. This was an age of assassins. Franz Joseph's wife, the Empress Elizabeth, had been murdered in 1898 in Switzerland by an Italian. But Austria did not seek war with Italy or Switzerland. And while a member of the Serbian Secret Intelligence Service, a man codenamed Apis, may or may not have been guilty of planning the murder, there was some argument and some slight evidence, but not convincing, that he was in fact behind the murder. He certainly assisted it. The murder itself did not necessarily mean war. There was no irresistible outburst of popular anger after the assassination, and Austria-Hungary did not take revenge in hot blood, but waited till the 28th of July before declaring war. When the Habsburg state did react against Serbia, it was in a calculated manner. And if the passage government in Serbia did not plan the killings, what about their response to the crisis that followed? Official Austrian reactions to the killing took two forms. First, the police and the courts undertook a wide-ranging series of investigations and arrests. Hundreds of people were arrested and questioned, sometimes quite violently. 25 people were eventually tried and convicted, although only a few were executed because so many of them were minors. Secondly, the Austrian Foreign Ministry and the Emperor's closest advisor considered what to do about Serbia's role in the plot. Investigators quickly learned that the murder weapon came from Serbian sources, but Austrian intelligence failed to distinguish between the roles of the passage administration and unofficial nationalist groups. For that matter, they blamed a group called Narodna Obrana for the crime, apparently unaware that the black members of the Black Hand were real culprits. Austria's responsibility for the war attaches to its calculated response for the murders. Their early war councils were divided. The Chief of Staff, General Franz Baron Konrad von Hotzendorf, he wanted a military response right at the outset. He'd previously argued that Serbia was a danger to the Austro-Hungarian Empire and should be put down by force of arms. The Habsburg Foreign Minister, Count Leopold von Berchtold, he generally agreed with Konrad. The only real opposition to the policy of confrontation and war came from the Hungarian Prime Minister, a man by the name of Stefan Tisza. Tisza was personally opposed to militarism and took the risks of war much more seriously than Hotzendorf did. Tisza was a Hungarian Prime Minister and ethnically a Magyar, and his concern was to keep the balance between the distribution of political power amongst the various nationalities on an even keel, not to give one national grouping more political power than any other. Now, the early consideration by the Austro-Hungarians of the situation shows how calculated they were in coming to the decision, because before they actually did anything, they approached Germany and got the Germans to issue what has become known as the blank check, which basically said to the Austro-Hungarians, look, Germany, you do what you need to do to settle this nasty business down in Serbia. You know, we'll back you all the way. And with that guarantee, the restraints, any restraint that was on the Austro-Hungarians was removed. They felt quite confident that they could do what they liked, and they took their decisions from there. Now, in previous incidents, for example, in the Balkan War of 1812, Berlin had not given their assurance of such support to the Austro-Hungarians. Nevertheless, at the meeting of July the 7th, the Austrian Council of Ministers decided on war. But they didn't attack straight away. They issued a 10-point ultimatum. Some of the demands they made was the suppression of anti-Austrian newspapers, suppression of anti-Austrian organisations in Serbia, a purge of anti-Austrian teachers and army officers, and the arrest of certain named nationalist activists. But there were two sticking points, two really important points, which the Austrians demanded of the Serbs, which the Serbs felt they couldn't really meet. The first was the Austrians demanded that their police help to suppress subversives on Serbian territory. And secondly, Austrian courts would help prosecute accused conspirators inside Serbia. Now, to any thrusting and committed nationalist, these two demands were really no-nos. They were too much of an intrusion onto what they considered their sovereignty. So the demands were finalised on July the 19th, but not sent to Belgrade until the 23rd. It had a 48-hour deadline. The war party in Vienna hoped that the Serbs would fail to agree, and this could be an excuse for war. As further evidence, the 48-hour time limit altered the document from a negotiating ploy to an ultimatum. We can say three things about how the Austrian process of decision bears on Austria's responsibility for the Great War. Firstly, the majority of the council ministers assumed from the first that war was the appropriate response. Negotiations with Serbia were really a sham to create a good impression internationally. The second clue to Austria's intent is Vienna's approach to Berlin for Germany's support in case of war. After the Berlin government responded with a so-called blank check, the decision makers in Vienna saw no further reason to seek peace. Thirdly, the terms of the ultimatum show that the Austrians came to a decision even though they were acting on incomplete information. The ultimatum was issued well before any assassins had been tried and found guilty. In other words, the decision for war was based on expediency and not on facts. What was the Serb reaction to all this? After all, we have here a country that had been independent since sometime in the 1830s and were used to running their own internal affairs. When Serbia first received the ultimatum, Pasic indicated that he could accept the terms, if even with a few reservations and a request for clarification. As time passed, however, it became clear that Russia would support Serbia regardless of the situation. After that, Pašić himself gave up seeking peace. He thought he had Russian backing, which would make the Austro-Hungarians think twice about invading Serbia. While a long reply was written and sent, Serbia rejected the key points about Austrian interference in domestic judicial and police work. Pašić knew this meant war, and the Serbian army began to mobilise even before the reply was received. Because the Serbian reply did not accept every point, Austria broke off relations on July the 25th. See, there was mutual willingness to take risks, to go right up to the brink. That in itself made war a much more likely outcome. And this leads to the last question. Why did the Balkan crisis of 1914 lead to World War I, when many other crises were resolved without a general war in Europe? These are really two questions. First, why did the crisis lead to war? And secondly, why did that conflict soon involve the rest of the great powers? So you can see, my argument is that the First World War started in the Balkans, not with the murder of Franz Ferdinand, but with the decision to take the crisis up to the brink and then go out for armed conflict. From what we've seen about risk taking by the Austro-Hungarians and the Serbs, we can say something about why those two states went to war in 1914. Firstly, both governments believed their prestige and credibility were on the line, not only in the international community, but at home. For the Austrians, a personal attack on the royal family required a strong response. The Serbs had defied the dual monarchy during the Pig War, which we've heard about recently. And for the Serbian regime, the humiliating Austrian terms would have undone all the progress made in achieving complete independence from Austria-Hungary. The economic Pig War, Austria's annexation of Bosnia in 1908, and now the demand to send police into Serbia, all implied a renewed Austrian control over Serbian affairs. In addition, we have to bear in mind that Pašić and his ministers faced a real risk that right-wing extremists would kill them if they backed down. And on the international stage, both sides were one defeat away from being marginalised. Austria-Hungary had no intention of replacing the Ottoman Empire as the sick man of Europe, and Serbia, with a highly expansive agenda, refused to be treated as a protectorate. Secondly, in 1914, both sides believed that they were in a strong position to win a war if it came. The Austrians had backing from Germany, and the Serbs had promises of support from Russia. Neither side considered the chance that the war would spread across Europe. Thirdly, neither side really believed that the difference could be settled by negotiation. Only one regime could rule the South Slavs in Bosnia. Fourthly, both sides focused on the fruits of victory while ignoring the costs of defeat. For example, the great Serb ideas that became Belgrade's war aims, namely annexation of Bosnia, Croatia and other parts of the Balkans. And as regards Austria-Hungary's, despite the promises given to Tisza that the war would bring no annexations of unwelcome Slavs. By 1916, the Vienna government had drawn up plans for the annexation of Serbia and Montenegro, as well as border districts in Russia and Italy, and an economic plan to make Albania and Romania into economic dependencies. Fifth, there was too little fear of war. It was entrenched as an acceptable means of settling differences that could not be settled by negotiation. Prior to the Sarajevo crisis, there had been the Greco-Turk War of 1897, the ethnic fighting in Macedonia and two Balkan Wars, and the Italian War with Turkey in 1911. We can see that war in the Balkans was really not all that unusual. Too many leaders in this crisis deliberately decided to risk crisis and war and mass slaughter was the result.